Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. As we enter another week of battling the coronavirus pandemic, here are a few updates. As of late yesterday, Pennsylvania has identified nearly 500 cases of the COVID-19 virus, and that number is sure to rise. Three people have now died from COVID-19 in Pennsylvania. Governor Tom Wolf's statewide order for all non-essential businesses to close went into effect at 8 a.m. today. Pennsylvania State Police began citing those businesses that aren't complying at 8 this morning. Governor Wolf said yesterday that he's considering a shelter-in-place order if the current restrictions don't keep people from social distancing and moving around. Smart Talk will continue to provide information throughout the current crisis. Child care centers around the Commonwealth are facing a tough choice: close their doors or get permission from the state to stay open. They can't operate without a waiver since Governor Wolf's blanket shutdown order to thousands of non-life-sustaining businesses across the state. The decision for some centers is based on the population they serve. For others, they are weighing the risk of COVID-19 against the needs of their employees and the parents who use their services. Joining us for the first portion of today's program is Pennsylvania Secretary of the Department of Human Services, Teresa Miller. Secretary Miller, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Secretary Miller, before we get into child care, and we'll also talk about Medicaid and telemedicine, what is the role of the Department of Human Services during the mitigation efforts of COVID-19 coronavirus?
Well, thanks for starting with that question. You know, the Department of Human Services makes it possible for millions of Pennsylvanians to have access to health care through our Medicaid programs. We provide access to food through the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. We provide temporary financial relief through our TANF program. So we provide a lot of services for millions of Pennsylvanians in a normal time. I think all of those services obviously become even more important when we're talking about a time like this where we're facing a pandemic. And so one of the difficult decisions that the governor made recently was continuing to keep our county assistance offices open, closed to the public, but continue to operate because we do serve such an important role in the lives of so many Pennsylvanians. So we are continuing to process applications. So if people need food or they need Medicaid coverage, we are there to continue to process those applications and make sure that A, no one loses benefits that they need, and B, that people who now find themselves in a situation where they need them will be able to access them.
Well, that's the big question, able to access them. How can Pennsylvanians at this time, when it is difficult to physically go to an office, how can they access those services?
They can access them online. That is actually the easiest way for people to access those services, through our Compass application. If they go to our website, they can get access to our Compass application and complete that. That's the fastest way to do it, and certainly the safest way during these times.
Mm-hmm. What is your website, just so, and we'll have this on our website as well, but what is your website for those who do need to access those services?
It's www.dhs.pa.gov.
Okay, and again, we will have a link to the Department of Human Services on our website, witf.org/smarttalk. Now, child care. I wanted to talk about child care this morning. When the governor made his order last week, even before the one coming later in the week, about shutting down non-life-sustaining businesses, one of the biggest concerns that we heard was for those people who were working, maybe attending school, that they had nowhere to go for child care, that the babysitters were approved or certified child care centers were closing down. What do you say to those people?
Well, I'm one of those people too.
Oh, really?
This has been a really tough time. My child care closed on Monday, along with most of them in the state. And You know, we've had to make some really tough decisions in the past week. I think it's important for listeners to know that, you know, we're taking all of our cues from the public health professionals at the state and federal levels who are working so hard to guide us through the crisis. But, you know, one of the decisions we had to make to close the spread of the virus is to close all childcare facilities that operate outside of a home. I do think it's important for folks to know that there is a waiver process for childcare centers that serve the children and families of essential personnel. And we know there are a lot of essential personnel out there. There are a lot of people who are healthcare workers, who are first responders, who are direct care workers. And I mentioned our government offices, even though they are closed to the public right now to make a safe environment for our workers, they are still hard at work processing applications for programs like Medicaid and SNAP, as I mentioned. So all of these people that are continuing to work through this crisis need access to childcare. And so that's why we have a waiver process for childcare facilities who are serving essential personnel. I think one of our challenges right now is going to be making sure we have enough childcare capacity, enough childcare facilities that are open to serve all the essential workers who are out there working. So, you know, right now we have about 7,400 licensed providers in the state. We have issued a little over 450 waivers to date. We have some emails continuing to come in. We are processing the waivers very quickly. For facilities who are requesting a waiver, they can remain open until they get that waiver. But I think one thing I would just say is we really are encouraging facilities, particularly if you are near a medical center and you served medical professionals, we would certainly encourage you to think about reopening if you've closed to serve those medical professionals. But we also know essential workers are much broader than just our medical professionals. We have hundreds of thousands of direct care workers and people that are still providing, you know, in-home services to our seniors and people with disabilities. So we have a lot of needs, and a lot of those are single moms who do need childcare. So for childcare facilities out there who don't know that a waiver is a possibility, if they're serving essential personnel, we certainly would encourage them to think about applying for a waiver. And then one of the things we're going to be doing is trying to then connect people who reach out who need services with those childcare facilities who are continuing to be open to serve essential personnel.
What is the criteria for being granted a waiver?
So the waiver process is actually very, very simple. It's a one-page form. I know most people probably don't think government is easy, and getting through red tape is not easy. This is a very easy process. One-page form, you fill out some basic information about your facility, your address, your contact information, and then there's a question about why you need the waiver, and that's where you just explain the essential personnel that you would be opening your facility to serve or you're continuing to serve. And that's it. One-page form, fill it out, you send it in. Again, you can continue to operate while you're waiting for that approval, but we've been processing these approvals pretty quickly as well.
And I just want to clarify, for those listening who do not have childcare right now, but not knowing how long this will last, what can they do? What are their options?
So, and you're talking about people who are not essential personnel.
I'm talking about anyone who is, yes, who must continue. Well, okay, I guess if they continue to work, they have to be essential personnel. But as you said yourself about your child care center, that if there are child care centers closing down now, many of them, maybe their children have been with the same place for years, how can they find another one?
So that's going to be the trick. If they today we have information, there's a website that is raiseyourstar.org. That gets you connected to your Early Learning Resource Center, what we call our ELRCs. And that is where people go today, even before the pandemic. That's where people would go if they wanted to find childcare in their area. The ELRCs are going to be up to date in terms of who has waivers, so they can help people find find childcare facilities that are still open. We're also working on putting a list of all the open facilities, the facilities that have waivers, on our website. We don't have that ready yet, but in the near future, we hope to have that as a resource so people can just go to our website and look and see which facilities are still open.
We have a question from Nikki in Hershey. It says, Secretary, a lot of people don't have access to internet right now. Are there other ways to access waivers, applications, and information?
Yes. So in terms of waivers, people can call our Office of Child Development and Early Learning, and that phone number is 1-877-4-PA-KIDS, K-I-D-S, or they can contact their child care certification representative.
I want to switch gears for you on you now, Secretary Miller. You also are issuing guidance to Medicaid-enrolled providers and managed care organizations how they can continue to provide services during this time. Telemedicine is one of the ways in which you're advising that they do that. In what way?
So we've been issuing guidance to our managed care organizations that they should make sure that they are allowing for telemedicine. So we know one of the big issues right now is just not having that close person-to-person contact. So we also know that you can have effective visits with your doctor, perhaps. We've also issued this guidance even broader than just the medical profession. We've issued this in our Office of Child Development and Early Learning when we're talking about things like home visiting and looking at ways that people can continue to do the work that they do, but just do it in a way that doesn't require that person-to-person contact. So the federal government has issued some guidance around this, and we are really pushing to have as much done through electronic means as possible. So this might mean FaceTime, for example, for people who have smartphones and can FaceTime. For people who don't, it might mean just a telephone call. We're trying to make sure that it's still an effective way to communicate, but really try to make sure that we're reducing that person-to-person contact.
Secretary Miller, we're almost out of time. You listed all the services that the Department of Human Services provides. Is there one that is urgent right now or one that stands out as a priority?
I think one of the focuses we have right now is food. We know, especially with the schools shut down, we know a lot of people, that's where their kids got meals. And so we expect that for some who were out of jobs and didn't expect to be out of jobs, that access to food could be a really big issue. We are working very hard to do what we can to, for example, get another SNAP payment out to people who are currently on SNAP. But one other thing I just want to let folks know about is we have a new resource that is really a partnership with a lot of different state and private entities. And we've come together in a what we're calling a feeding task force. So this is public, private, nonprofit partners from across the state, Salvation Army, Feeding PA, Pennsylvania Food Merchants Association. And we're going to be kind of a centralized hub where we're identifying available resources, determining where the needs are, how many meals people need, how we're getting food to people, how we're getting volunteers to help charitable food networks. So that is something we're working on. We're trying to get a survey out there so we can find out where the needs are and then make sure we're meeting those needs. The last thing I would just say is if people are healthy and they're sitting at home looking for something to do, our local food charitable networks need volunteers. Those are essential services. So if they're healthy, they can go volunteer at a local food bank and make sure that we're getting everyone in Pennsylvania fed during this difficult time.
Pennsylvania Secretary of Human Services, Teresa Miller, thank you very much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Governor Tom Wolf's order last week that resulted in a shutdown of all non-life-sustaining businesses created some confusion at the time. Even though a list of what was considered life-sustaining and what wasn't was provided, some questioned whether their businesses fell into the categories listed. More than 10,000 sought waivers from the shutdown order. Joining us now is Gene Barr, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry. Gene Barr, welcome to the program.
Scott, how you doing?
I'm doing well. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Early last week, Gene, you stood with Governor Wolf when he made the initial announcement encouraging businesses to shut down. Later in the week, when the governor put on a few more restrictions, talking about all non-life-sustaining businesses to shut down. There seemed to be some confusion, as I said, and the chamber voiced some concern about it. What were your concerns, and do you still have them?
Yeah, the first time that we stood with the governor, I think it was actually a week ago Friday, relative to the Montgomery County situation. It seemed to be, certainly seemed to be the epicenter in Pennsylvania. I guess Philly is now worse now. Then later on, he kind of talked about essential versus non-essential and then moved to something called life-sustaining versus non-life-sustaining. And look, I completely get the governor is trying to act quickly. There is no playbook. Nobody's got a COVID-19 playbook they can take off the shelf and say, here's what you do. We're trying to move a lot of this as, you know, along as we go. But when that was announced Thursday with just basically a 4 hours notice, certainly, yes, it did involve some confusion. At the same time that was going on, the Department of Homeland Security was coming up with some definitions under critical infrastructure they were suggesting to the nation's governors to use, and the governor's order kind of got out before that got fully circulated. So on Friday, he came back and made some changes. He decided to use what's called the CISA, critical infrastructure standards, along with his, which has helped. But we're still working to work through some of the confusion with using kind of two side-by-side standards.
Well, and again, the confusion was what is essential or, you know, life-sustaining or non-life-sustaining. I think one of the points that I think you made and some of your members made is that even though on the surface it may not appear to be a life-sustaining business, there are supply chains. Talk about that if you would.
Absolutely. I mean, when, for example, you say, oh, well, hospitals are life-sustaining, we would all agree with that. Unfortunately, some of the, under the governors, it was basically a five-page where they went through industry by industry and checked yes or no. A lot of those are part of the critical infrastructure to supply things to hospitals and other industries and other operations deemed to be life-sustaining. For example, we had people who supplied things to the hospital industry and other industries that are life-sustaining, but couldn't continue because, for example, the pallets they used to ship things weren't deemed to be appropriate. We had, for example, paper products. And this time, we all seen what's happened with paper products. Well, you know, they were deemed to be life-sustaining, but unfortunately, the timber industry was told to shut down. Well, that's where we get the pulp for the paper products. So we needed a kind of a more detailed, a comprehensive solution to that, which is why we're able to work with the administration and come up with their adoption of these critical infrastructure explanations that helped move us forward a bit. Then, of course, people were invited to apply for exemptions, and there was a kind of a further complication because some people applied for exemptions late Thursday, early Friday morning, when in fact they were covered under CISA, and that has kind of complicated the process as well.
So what you're describing then is a lot of businesses that are questioning, okay, am I on the list? Am I not on the list? Should I be on the list or should I not be on the list? So where do we stand as of Monday morning?
As of Monday, the Department of Community Economic Development has kicked out a lot of the exemptions. If they're not all done, I think they shortly will be. What I would say to businesses is this. If you're unsure about where you are, the first thing to do is you take the governor's order that came out on Thursday night. If it says that you as a business under your industry or business can continue to operate, you're good, you continue to operate. If it says no, then you go over and you take the CISA standards that are also posted on the department's website. They're also on our website, pachamber.org, and you look under there. If you as a business owner or your attorneys look at that and believe that you are part of one of those industries and supply chains, et cetera, that fall under the CISA standards, then you should stay open. I would encourage you, if you believe that, do not apply for a waiver. That is where some of this has come about. So that's what we're urging businesses to do, a two-step process. Look at the governors. If it's yes, you're good. If it's no, you move on to CISA. And if you believe you fall under those, you should continue to operate.
So, Gene, how are your members, how are businesses across Pennsylvania adapting to this?
Well, adapting to the closure, it's difficult. I mean, it went from where it hit the hospitality industry hard to where now, obviously, it's rippling across other industries. We are working with the administration to try and look at other places where we can have people work to where they can, of course, maintain distancing, et cetera. One of the changes that was made over the weekend was they've allowed the landscaping industry to operate. One of the things that we're thinking about and continuing to talk to them about is are there different standards for people who work outside and where you can practice social distancing? It's one of the things that we're encouraging them to look at. And look, we're all working through this. We're in constant contact to see how we can continue to balance, to do that crucial balance of protecting human health, stopping the spread of this virus, and, of course, continuing to keep Pennsylvania's economy operating.
I also understand that you probably have heard from a lot of your members who, they probably are very sympathetic to what the governor is going through and why this is important that we do this, but at the same time are probably very, very concerned about the future of their livelihoods.
Absolutely. No question about it, which is why we've got to move to push out the federal legislation that has the one piece that has come out already. Hopefully they will work through the issues that they have in Washington over the larger stimulus package. The state is making their move to try and assist small business, so we're trying to encourage people to move as quickly as possible. Other businesses and industries who are still operating, I know, are attempting to assist others trying to provide assistance to smaller businesses and individuals. I know banks are doing certain things to make sure that their customers can get through this process as well, because it quite clearly is a difficult process. We've also been working with the healthcare industry to try and encourage businesses who might have extra personal protective equipment, which is running very short in those industries. One, if you have extra, please donate it or sell it, I guess. Two, if there are industries, and we're seeing a little bit of this, if there are industries who can turn around their process, for example, they're making garments, can you take and turn around your process to where you're making masks, gowns, gloves? That would be a great assist as well.
What do businesses need from the government? When this, we're talking about stimulus, when we're talking about a rescue package, what do they need?
Well, look, they need immediate help. They need, if it is loans, they have to be loans, for example, that are, that don't come due immediately, that have low, if no, interest rates. A lot of the discussions that are out there, if you keep your people on, those loans will convert to grants. They need immediate assistance. And allowing them, for example, for businesses to keep their quarterly tax filings or at least delay them significantly, that will keep cash flow in those businesses. We need to move very quickly. I think that Congress has done that. Administration has done that from their financial assistance proposals. We're looking to push that out, but there's still more that needs to be done. We need, obviously, things that will encourage businesses to keep their people on the payroll to the maximum extent possible. That comes from both, making sure that we're forcing that we're only forcing those businesses to close where there's no, viable option for them to operate safely, and trying to keep provide enough assistance they can keep their people on. It's a multi-pronged attempt here.
We have a question from Heath in York County. Heath, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing well.
Hey, I was just calling just to make a suggestion, perhaps. Due to the lack in traffic that we're seeing and whatnot, but yet the current, outside my window, there's highways workers working diligently in the rain and snow. But I thought it would be a great time to center on repairing the infrastructure of Pennsylvania and just the terrible situation as far as we have looking forward
Hey, Heath, thank you very much for your call. Gene, I don't know whether you could address this or not, but there have been a lot of people who have made this suggestion. While there is not as much traffic on the roads, that it is an opportunity for an upgrade in infrastructure.
Yeah, there is. And, of course, we're entering into the prime construction time of the year as well. The Speaker of the House has sent a letter to the governors kind of saying the same thing, and I think that the administration continues to look at opportunities to do this. They're saying, hey, where we've got unsafe bridges, we're doing it, but I think they're continuing to look at places where they can have those workers work safely. That is, again, practice distancing 6 feet apart, et cetera. I think they'll continue to look at that as an opportunity because, as noted, the lack of traffic certainly presents opportunities in a lot of places.
And, Gene, again, I don't know whether you can answer this question or not, but a listener who says, I'm self-employed as a house painter and a paper hanger. Like many painting contractors in my area, I do not have a physical storefront and usually work alone but work inside others' homes. As far as being on the life-sustaining list, we as painters are considered special trade contractors and are not allowed to continue work. Is this the case? I'm confused if I and others who are self-employed continue to work. I don't know whether you can answer. Well, I'll let you answer it if you can or not, but it does bring up a bigger point.
My understanding from the list is that if you're doing repairs, that you can continue to do that. You know, for example, if you're going out to repair someone's roof leak, that's acceptable. If you're going out because they just decide they want a new roof, then that's not something that you should be doing at this point. So if there's an issue, and as a painter, you know, paper hanger, it's probably tough to say that it's, you know, it's an emergency situation for the wallpaper. So I think he's probably in a tough position. But again, we're going to continue to look at when we can expand the list of businesses that can be operating. You know, this thing is not etched in stone. This is what the governor has come up with. It's what Homeland Security has come up with. And we continue to look at other opportunities to add to that as we can do that safely.
Gene Barr, who is president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry. Gene, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. When families are asked to quarantine at home, those who fear or experience domestic violence are suddenly thrust into a potentially dangerous situation. We're joined now by Julie Bancroft. She's the Chief Public Affairs Officer with the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Ms. Bancroft, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm doing well. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are @SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I have to admit, Julie, that when these restrictions started coming into place on the state level, federally, across the country, one of my first thoughts is that there are some families that may not be the happiest, that are in some volatile situations to begin with, and now a lot of them, they probably will refer to themselves as being cooped up and be together much more often, that there is potential when there is domestic violence in the home. What about that?
Yeah, absolutely, Scott. So the situation that we're all facing right now, as you said, this could be a stressful situation in a household with couples or families where there are healthy relationships. So in those households where abuse or any type of domestic violence is present, whether it's emotional abuse or verbal abuse, this can really heighten the risk to survivors of domestic violence, and can also, as you said, really exasperate kind of the stress that everyone's dealing with right now, which really does put victims at in a really unfortunate situation, especially because looking at safety planning, typically that would look at how could you exit the home safely, can you go stay with friends or family, can you go into shelter, and of course all of those things are being compromised at this time because we are being advised to social distance and to stay home.
Well, okay, let's try to answer some of those questions that you just asked that you're getting. What can someone do if they feel their life is in danger, their safety is in danger, the life of their lives of their children are in danger? I mean, under normal circumstances, first of all, it's a tough decision anyway to try to get out of that situation. But under these circumstances, it has to be much more stressful and deciding, okay, do I risk the safety of exposing to COVID-19 or is our lives in danger here if we stay home?
Absolutely. So I think the most important thing for listeners to know is that help is going to remain available throughout this crisis. And it might look a little different than it has in the past, shifting to more telecounseling models and or video chat. But help is available through the National Domestic Violence Hotline and through the 59 local domestic violence programs in the state. So that's the first thing to know. And by contacting either the local domestic violence program or the national hotline, counselors can help survivors navigate safety planning or to put safety plans in place in this situation, weighing all the risks of, is it safe to go to a family member's house? Is it safe to leave? We talk a lot about, when a victim does try to leave an abusive situation, that is often the most dangerous time for them. So that is also something that needs to be considered and should be discussed with an advocate. And they can also look at safety planning within the home. So that's something that is unique to this situation, but may be required.
Like what? What kind of mean? What kind of precautions and plans for the home?
So that could look like is there somewhere in the house that you can protect yourself? I mean, even something like a small powder room or a closet. And obviously, that's not ideal. But if that is necessary, kind of thinking about that in advance. If you're suddenly at risk of being harmed, is there a place in the home that you can go for safety? Also being aware of whether or not there are weapons in the home. Unfortunately, we're seeing in Pennsylvania and across the state an increase in firearms purchases, which is very dangerous for victims of domestic violence. So being aware of whether or not there are weapons in the home, are they safely secured, and where are they located? Another challenge that survivors may face in the home that could compromise their safety during this crisis is abusers may actually try to prohibit access to things like personal hygiene products like soap and hand sanitizer and disinfectants to actually all the things that we all need right now to try to stay healthy. They also might keep information about the pandemic from the survivors or give them misinformation, creating more fear and also more anxiety around how do I keep myself and my family safe.
One of the things that I've seen on social media, and most people are doing this, I don't know, to be funny or in a humorous way, but it does take on a serious tone when you're thinking about domestic violence, and that is the number of people who are talking about stocking up on alcohol during this time when they are at home. Again, they may be doing it to be humorous, or that's the way that they relax when they're at home. But when domestic violence is an issue, that could create even a more dangerous situation.
It could create a more hostile situation, but there isn't a direct correlation to alcohol abuse and domestic violence. So domestic violence is all about coercive power and control over the victim. Now, adding in substance abuse and like I said, weapons, that of course can exasperate a situation and make those situations more dangerous.
Have you seen an uptick, or have you seen any kind of trends since this started last week or 2 weeks ago?
I don't have solid data, but anecdotally, this is, of course, it creates significant challenges for our advocates that are working directly with survivors. But despite that, help is still available, like I said. So the 59 domestic violence programs across the state are really what they have to do is get creative about how they're serving clients. And because, you know, it's very possible that they may reach shelter capacity because of people needing to access safety, or they might actually have folks that are fearful of coming into shelter because of the health crisis. So looking at new models like using hotels for housing and a night, like I said earlier, telecounseling, doing things, even advising on court, navigating the courts and protection from abuse orders, doing that remotely through web chat and telephone. So all of these things, I think it's there's definitely going to be an uptick, but right now the programs are really focusing on how to shift their resources and respond to survivors as this crisis evolves.
So that hotline number, what is that hotline number? We'll be sure to put it on our website, WITF.org, as well.
Sure. So I would first say our website, PCADV.org. If you go to our site, there's a Find Help section. You can find the local domestic violence program in your community. They all have hotline numbers. And then there's also the National Domestic Violence Hotline. That number is 1-800-799-7233. And their website is thehotline.org. I would also add that both PCADV and the hotline have dedicated pages on their websites specifically about navigating domestic violence during the COVID-19 crisis. So there are a lot of helpful information on both of those sites as well.
Julie Bancroft is the Chief Public Affairs Officer with the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Julie, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Stay safe.
Take care.
And we will continue throughout the week, by the way, on Smart Talk with new information every day, looking at different aspects of COVID-19, of the coronavirus. We are hearing from many of the experts that this could get worse before it gets better. That 15-day, a week ago, 7 days ago, that we were told 15 days will be reassessed as to what happens as far as staying home and social distancing. So some decisions will be made in those areas, and we will be sure to keep you updated on that as well. A little bit of history now. 100 years ago, the 1918 flu claimed the lives of an estimated 50 million people worldwide and 675,000 in the United States. Dr. Michael Nyberg is a professor of history and chair of the War Studies Department of National Security and Strategy at the United States Army War College, here to talk about the Spanish flu. Dr. Nyberg, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Scott. Good morning.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Nyberg, we are in the very early stages of this COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic. The Spanish flu of 1918 went over a certain amount of time. But in these early stages, are there any parallels between the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918?
It certainly feels very familiar and present to me as an historian. It is a global crisis that began in one corner, probably in Kansas, and quickly moved across the globe. It's creating a lot of confusion. It's creating a lot of variation in local responses, some communities reacting to this much better than others. And, of course, the way that it's overwhelming governments and institutions and forcing them to come up with stopgap and very quick solutions, that's all very characteristic of the Spanish flu of 1918-1919.
Well, let's start with overwhelming governments. Describe that, if you would. What happened in 1918? How were governments overwhelmed with this?
It's absolutely critical to place this in the context of the First World War, where governments are doing everything that they possibly can to win the war, which meant that their eyes really weren't as institutions on this disease as it was spreading. So the very famously in Philadelphia, the city authorities decided to go on with a Liberty Bond parade, which drew about 40,000 people to downtown Philadelphia and packed them in and created tremendous problems for the city of Philadelphia, which was really, really badly hit. The U.S. government also continued to ship soldiers overseas, even when it knew that it was going to be shipping men with influenza into port cities in France and from there to the Western Front, and when it knew that all that was going to happen. So the priority for governments at that point was trying to win the First World War. And just as now, some governments reacted more rapidly than others did, and some had circumstances, geographic or otherwise, that let them move a little quicker than others did. But for all of them, it's rooted in this context of the war.
You know, you brought up Philadelphia and what happened in 1918. We have seen more about that in the past week or so than probably in the last 100 years, because it's been used as an example of flattening the curve, of why flattening the curve means a lot. Talk about that, if you will.
There were a few communities that got on this pretty quickly. So a friend of mine just sent me something from New Brunswick in Canada, actually had the British Empire's only Department of Public Health in 1917, and they moved very quickly. The doctors there and government officials there realized that the best way to keep New Brunswick safe was to do what we're doing right now, put everybody in isolation, shut off streetcars, close cinemas, close churches, and as a result, New Brunswick emerged pretty strong. Port cities are very difficult to do this, of course, as people are coming in and out and moving around. So Philadelphia and Boston are hit particularly hard. So in some cases, it's the response of governments. In some cases, it's the response of local governments combined with the circumstances that they find themselves in.
I had a question here from a listener. If it began in Kansas, why do they call it the Spanish flu?
It's a great question. They call it the Spanish flu because Spain was neutral during the First World War, which meant that its press was not censored. So the United States, Britain, France did not want Germany, did not want information about the flu getting into the media for fear that their enemies on the battlefield would get clues about maybe where it was hitting the hardest or just how bad it was. Spain, on the other hand, had none of those restrictions, so it became known as the Spanish flu. The Spanish king also suffered from it, was one of the early victims of it, so that made news as well. So even though it's called the Spanish flu, there's no connection between Spain and the origins of the influenza. But that's a great question.
But starting in Kansas, over the years, historians have debated exactly where it did start. But as you mentioned earlier, that it may have started in Kansas amongst U.S. Military personnel?
What we think is the case. The evidence strongly suggests that it began in Kansas, Haskell County, Kansas. It's the first place we have a doctor describing the symptoms accurately of what he was seeing. And then there is a movement, of course, of people from that region of Kansas to Fort Riley, which was a major center for training of American troops, which is, I think, about 200 or so miles northeast of Haskell County. So we think both from the epidemiology, which I'm certainly not an expert in, and from the records of this doctor, that the first place we see it is in Kansas.
So the Spanish flu, what made it different than other forms of influenza?
As you know, there were other forms of influenza. There had been an influenza outbreak in 1915. There had been infectious disease in the Spanish-American War, the digging of the Panama Canal. So the fact that bringing a lot of men and animals together in a concentrated place could create disease was certainly not something that was terribly surprising. What surprised people about this one was how fast it spread and how quickly it could produce fatal consequences. So people could actually get their first symptoms and 12 hours later be dead. And this one is particularly horrifying. You'll see descriptions of people bleeding out of ears and noses, the skin going blue as the body was no longer able to deliver oxygen. So that's another thing that people remarked on a lot. And finally, this particular strand of influenza killed young people at a particularly high rate, which was something that confused doctors in the early days. It was killing healthy, military-aged people, which, again, in the context of the war, is a particular concern.
You mentioned being around animals. What does it have to do with how the Spanish flu started?
Again, I'm not that kind of doctor, but what the literature suggests is that this influenza was able to move quickly between animals and people. That is, animals could be a carrier or what a fomite of the disease. And that's why things like avian flu, things like that, that's what we mean when they can move between people and they can move between animals. So if you think about an army assembling men, assembling animals, you know, horses, mules, pigs, all kinds of things to feed that army. And, of course, when I say men, of course, I mean men and the numbers of female volunteers who are involved as well. When all those things are coming together, you can imagine the epidemiological environment as things are moving back and forth.
There are some big changes, or have been some big changes, in many, many, many areas since 1918 in medical science, in communications. I mean, obviously, those things have changed a lot with this pandemic as compared to the Spanish flu pandemic. But one thing in 1918 I think about, there's a war going on. And for historians who have studied warfare and for those who have participated, you often hear them describe it as, you know, not only bloody, dangerous, that they're afraid, but how filthy it was. World War One, in particular, many people think of trench warfare right off the bat. I mean, that could not have helped this situation when there's a war going on, there's people being wounded, they're living in foxholes and trenches. All those things had to contribute to this.
Absolutely, absolutely. So you have that problem of trench warfare and people being very close together. You also have the problem even behind the lines of training camps and assembly camps, and you also have the problem of just the basic problem of public health being degraded, which is why it goes global and it hits almost every corner of the globe. But you're absolutely right. It hit some armies harder than others. We think it hit the German army a little bit harder, in part because the public health and nutrition standards of the German army at that part were very bad because the German system was beginning to completely unravel. But again, you just can't separate this from the war itself.
In 1918, was the United States, was the world prepared for a pandemic like this?
Absolutely not. No, nobody was prepared for this. It's part of the reason why the numbers are just as astonishing as they are. By some estimates, one-third of the world's population was infected at one point or another. The numbers are just astonishing. Average life expectancy in the U.S. dropped by 12 years. The numbers are just mind-boggling, and very few communities were prepared to handle this. A place like New Brunswick, with local leaders who were ready for this in a sort of way, and in a geographic location where they could isolate a little bit, were able to put some protections up. But I think American Samoa is the only place that showed no influenza casualties at all, and obviously their geographic situation is really different. So, no, nobody was ready for this.
So how did it finally end?
We think that it is, like many viruses, that it began to mutate and adapt to its own circumstances. So there appear to be about three waves. And then about the middle of 1919, you see the numbers of these cases begin to decline. And again, the epidemiological literature, which I'm not an expert in, suggests that the various mutations of this virus, eventually it simply becomes less lethal than the two versions, or three versions, we think, now that came before.
Was there a vaccine eventually?
No, not in 1919. And in fact, it's an issue that comes up a lot. There are issues for inoculation, which I guess is a little bit different than vaccines. There are ways to sort of protect in advance, but there really aren't ways to handle it once the vaccine has infected someone. So when I'm often asked what I think the most important lesson of the First World War is, my response is get a flu shot, because it is the one thing that all kind of historians agree on. It's an offhand line, but an important one.
What was the effect of the Spanish flu on World War One?
We think there were at least a couple that we seem to agree on. One I sort of mentioned, which is that it seems to have hit the German army very hard at a point when the German army was already quite fragile. So it does appear to have had an influence on breaking the German army's morale at the end of 1919. Most people didn't think the war was going to end in 1918, excuse me. It also appears that the Germans made a conscious decision not to move their soldiers from the Eastern Front to the Western Front, in part because they thought that they might bring influenza with them. So there was that military end of it. And there are also people who think it's certainly clear that Woodrow Wilson suffered from at least one bout of influenza, maybe two, And there are some historians who think that it began to cloud his judgment at the end of the Paris Peace Conference.
Wow. Dr. Michael Nyberg, he's a professor of history and chair of the War Studies in the Department of National Security and Strategy at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. Dr. Nyberg, thank you very much for your insights.
Always a pleasure talking to you, Scott.
Thank you. We will continue talking about COVID-19 coronavirus on tomorrow's Smart Talk, so be sure to tune in.